Hi, and welcome to Intersection on KBIA. I'm Janet Saidi. On this episode, we're coming down from the True False Film Festival Inspiration High. KBIA's crew was out all weekend catching up with directors, attendees, capturing some of the sights and sounds. Here's a roundup of some True False moments on this episode of Intersection. For the last 16 years, True False has transformed the downtown streets of Columbia into a vibrant, rambunctious, and creative film festival, not just for Missourians to enjoy, but for people all over the country to come and experience. To kick off the weekend celebration, crowds lined the sidewalks of 9th Street and watched paraders in colorful wigs dancing to the beat of drums, characters 8 feet tall on stilts, and even full-body costumes of frogs, of course. Ricky Richards traveled all the way from New York for the festival and enjoyed the parade dancing to music that brought her, her friends, and tens of other random strangers together. KBIA's Molly Dove spoke to Richards and others and captured some of the energy of True False in this audio postcard.
Turn it up!
It's been great. I've been volunteering a little bit, trying to catch some screenings, participating in the parade. I'm already trying to plan my costume for next year. It's been a blast. This is a really good introduction to the town, for sure.
My name is Barbie Banks. The parade's the best. It's, we're the only film festival that has a parade, so it's unique, and it brings out the community, and doesn't matter if you have a pass or a ticket, you get to be a part of it.
Oh, I love it. I just love it. And I love seeing all the people, and I get to see people that I know, people that I don't know. And it's just, it's a wonderful, wonderful experience. My name's Carolyn Magnuson. I'm a Q Queen. A Q Queen is a mobile, flamboyant information station. My costume is I think probably a traditional queen costume, but I made it into a True False Q Queen, and I wear it every year. True False is a wonderful event to bring the community together. There are several reasons why I come out. One of them is because I love Columbia. And I love being able to show off Columbia to visitors. I also truly love True False. So being able to put those two loves together is a real exciting experience for me. So it just energizes me. Like right now I'm exhausted, but I'm gonna keep going because of the energy that's around.
That was an audio postcard from the True False Film Festival by KBIA's Molly Dove. Midnight in Paris was one of the films featured at True False. The film is set in Flint, Michigan. Before the water crisis, Flint had a reputation revolving around crime and drugs. But directors Ronnie Moore and James Blagden decided to change the lens and focus on something positive, prom night. KBIA's Emily Aiken spoke with the directors. Here's an excerpt from their conversation.
Hi, I'm Ronnie Moore, director of Midnight in Paris here at True or False Festival.
And James Blagden, co-director of Midnight in Paris, and we're at the True False Film Festival.
So my first question is, how did you guys meet?
I moved to New York 2005, 2006, went there for college, finished college there. One of the first jobs I got out of college. James also was sort of a part of that ecosystem. We met through work, I guess. Yeah, working together, which then turned into actual friendship. And then, I guess, a working relationship outside of working together, I guess.
Yeah, the kind of friendship that you develop into collaboration, a collaborator and a creative confidant.
Yes.
So how did you guys come up with the idea that you wanted to make this film? Where did it all start?
I was just going to say it's interesting because I think we both came to it together but also separately. Personally, I was working as an animator and I had minor success in the field and was feeling like I wanted to start pushing myself towards making live action films. At that time, Ronnie and I were, as we said, friends and interested in working together. And we were talking at the time about different ideas for things. And I was particularly interested in institutions, sort of American institutions. Enter Ronnie. He knew about the prom and how special it was, how much energy went into it, and not just from the kids, but the people around them, the sort of ecosystem of support and excitement around graduation and the prom, which, you know, just because the reality is kind of juxtaposed to what people know about Flint outside of Flint. So there's all these kind of preconceived notions about Flint, and none of them were very positive. So I think we were interested in, without being, you know, like overtly like having a plan to like go there and make this particular film, we were just being who we were, didn't want to make a film that was going to exploit anybody or romanticize poverty or, as has been talked about, black pain, and this was the result.
Yeah, Flint is a part of me, so I was very close to the story.
What are some of the challenges that you faced while shooting?
To be honest, it wasn't really... I mean, we were so into the idea and the concept that a lot of that just carried us to sort of... It sort of just willed us through to get what we wanted to do. And not to sound corny or whatever, but it was just such a good energy the whole time we were there where people were really receptive. Like, they appreciated the fact that we were excited about prom, that we wanted to tell this story. I think they could feel our energy about, you know, not trying to be exploitive or not trying to play anyone out. I feel like the feedback has been like a feel good piece. People are like, yo, that made me feel good. And it's like, but I think that's like the energy just translated from the time we were shooting and we stepped foot there. Like, that was just the vibe, I think.
I don't know. It's weird to think of it as a feel good because it is, because it does exist in such a particular space. But yeah, I mean, we enjoyed ourselves while we were there. People were really warm and receptive and welcoming, and like Ronnie said, appreciated that we were, you know, interested in the prom, because as big as it is, they were kind of like, oh, why, like, you know, you guys haven't seen prom like this?
We were like, no. It was very normal to them, so yeah. They were like, yeah. Yeah, this is how we do things around here, sort of attitude from their end.
Yeah, so they kind of, I think they realized it was a chance for them too to kind of present themselves.
Everyone takes away something different from film, but if you could say, like, this is what I want everyone in that theater to take away from this film, what would it be?
I guess that life is complicated and that there are terrible things, a lot of sadness and a lot of joy, and they can be like in the same hat. One of the best things I feel like we heard in the process of making this, I don't know the exact quote, but it was something to the effect of, like, that was weird and sad, but also beautiful.
Yeah, I think I want people to just come away with it with, I guess, a non-judgmental eye. Everybody just wants the same thing at the end of the day.
That was KBIA's Emily Aiken speaking with Ronnie Moore and James Blogden, the directors of the true-false film Midnight in Paris. You're listening to Intersection on KBIA. I'm Janet Saidi. Today we're reminiscing about some of our favorite true-false moments. You can see more on this discussion at kbia.org. Young suicides affect a small town? That's the question asked by director Juan Pablo Gonzalez in his film Caballerango. The film takes place in Gonzalez's hometown, a small village in the state of Jalisco, Mexico. It focuses on Nando, the son of a horse wrangler, and his death's effect on the community. KBIA's Sam Mosher sat down with Gonzalez to discuss the film, and just a brief warning, the content in this conversation might be a little heavy for some listeners.
And how did you come across a story that's so personal and intimate?
Well, this film is shot in rural Jalisco, and I'm from the town that I shot the film in. And I've known Nando's family for many, many years since I was a kid. I moved away a few years ago when I was around 10, 11. And then I decided to go back to make the film many years after that.
I see. And so was that difficult for you going back to the place where you're from and dealing with a family that you've known for quite a while?
So yeah, the beginning was quite hard. It was, I don't know if hard is exactly the word. It was just strange. It was a new experience for me. It was a new experience also for them. But then as I started working there, I've been working there for about 5 years. It became actually very comfortable for both of us. So I think it was also sort of a way for me to reconnect with them and reconnect also with the town itself, with my hometown.
What is it like working on a film that deals with such with dark and heavy subject matter? Suicide is a hard thing. It's a very tough thing. How do you work on a film with that type of subject and still get across what you're looking for without letting it, you know, hurt you personally?
Yeah, I think that it's an interesting question because my only answer would be like the how do you work on a film like that is, for me, it's just that's the type of films that I make. All of my films are in a way, you know, take the viewer in. You could say, I don't know if you would call it a dark place. It's just, you know, a place of maybe certain level of reflection around death and memory, and also certain sort of heavy feeling of nostalgia, melancholia. But this is sort of, that is sort of who I am, so it's a natural impulse for me. Now the sort of everyday life process of working through these films, the emotional elements of the material, you're not in touch with those elements constantly, but it's not like every day that you're watching footage and you're editing footage, you're going through these intense emotions. Because I mean, I think if it was a case, I don't know if I could make these films, you know. I think they would affect me personally too much. But the film, you know, sort of in terms of topic specifically, it's about a series of suicides that have populated the town, or that have been happening in this town, especially amongst very young people. And it is in a way, and the film, you know, it's not trying to explain why these things happen. It's more trying to offer a portrait of the experience of the people that are left alive, basically. That is right now, for this town specifically, a very present issue. That, you know, this had never happened in this form at least before, you know, 10 years ago, 20 years ago. And it's also new in terms of the way people talk about it. Like, people did not talk about depression, did not talk about suicide, or the type of feelings that you experience when a loss from suicide happens in your family, right? Because it was just a phenomenon that they weren't experiencing before.
I totally see that. Now, on that topic of going there and observing the culture of this town with the context of also doing a film about these series of young suicides that happened, did your viewpoint of the town change at all after looking at it in that way?
My look of this town, of this place, has changed radically since I went back to start making films here. For me, it has allowed me to experience this place as a place that is contemporary, that is complex, that has many, many political, social, and cultural layers that are not usually thought of in the rural, right? And also, yeah, you know, seeing families that are struggling with these issues, trying to find ways of dealing with them without any kind of support, right? Without any kind of institutional support, without, it's basically the community that are helping each other, right? So I think that was also very revealing, you know, this sort of communal life that has to be generated because of the lack of resources in a way.
Cabe Yarongo made its U.S. debut at the 2019 True False Film Fest. The film's director, Juan Pablo Gonzalez, spoke with KBIA's Sam Mosier. The director told Sam he likes True False because of the opportunity to engage with audiences after the film. This year's festival also featured 3-hour-long documentary shorts programs, including Lasting Marks, the latest short by returning filmmaker Charlie Lyne. Lyne sat down with KBIA's Sebastian Martinez Valdivia to talk about his film and some of the shorts that got his attention this year.
To start off with, can you describe your film and its kind of unique presentation?
Sure, yeah. So my new film, Lasting Marks, is about this quite infamous legal trial that happened in Britain 30 years ago. In which a group of 16 men were prosecuted for having private, consensual, sadomasochistic sex sessions. And it became something of a kind of tabloid sensation at the time and set this very controversial legal precedent in Britain that basically says that consent is irrelevant when it comes to various matters, including sadomasochism.
And then the film itself, instead of going and talking to a bunch of these people on camera or anything, you presented it mainly through documents.
Yeah, so it's a documentary in the most literal sense possible. So you hear an interview with one of the men who was prosecuted at the time, but visually all you're seeing is various quite kind of clinical static documents, so press clippings, court transcripts. The idea is essentially that these documents tell the story as it was presented to the world at the time, and that hopefully you see how inadequate that version of events was in various ways. So it's quite a kind of clinical viewing experience, but hopefully the kind of expressive emotion of the interview that you hear works in contrast to that.
And this isn't the first time that you've seen it on a big screen, but how were your screenings here?
Yeah, great. No, and it is always like strange to see it on a big screen because so as it's just documents, it's a portrait shape, and it for the most part is just like a big white screen with some black text on it
and so big black bars on either side.
Yeah, so very imposing. It has a sort of weirdly like religious feel almost when this kind of great massive white comes up on the screen. But yeah, no, it was great, and like you know, it's such a sort of unusual form that it's always interesting to see how people are engaging with it, because I'm to some extent trying to guide people through each document, and kind of there's, you know, various ways that your eyes are drawn to certain details, but people frequently tell me that they find themselves kind of wandering and trying to discern other aspects of what's being presented on screen, which is exactly the point, to, you know, put a bit of control into the hands of the viewer.
What are some of the short films that stood out to you or that you found yourself thinking more about?
So I have seen all of the shorts, which was a pleasure, actually. There were only 3 programs, and they were all only an hour long, which is, like, ideal, especially when you're watching, like, quite intense films back-to-back. I think that's a kind of apt runtime. The one that immediately comes to mind is one I saw yesterday called Dramatic and Mild, which is a film about a Kandinsky painting returning to Moscow after many, many decades outside of the country. And for reasons that aren't entirely explained in the film, at least as far as I remember, it's being presented in what looks like a kind of small office kitchen on this like building site somewhere in Moscow. And so what you witness is kind of visitor after visitor go into this very pokey little room and look at this presumably extremely valuable painting, which because of its value is being guarded by this extremely charismatic, oddball,
very buff
guy. He is huge, and I can't tell if his head is actually small or if it just appears small because of the sheer scale of his body. But he's already like a visually odd presence in the room. And then his manner is even, you know, more kind of unexpected and delightful because he takes it upon himself to kind of inform visitors about, you know, what they may be interpreting from this Kandinsky painting. And he seems to have done his research about, like, the life of Kandinsky. And as far as I'm aware, this was all, you know, fairly uncontrived, that this guy had just sort of taken it upon himself to do it. And it becomes this really, like, wonderful, playful film about kind of art and, like, the role of art in people's lives, and especially, you know, the commerce of art and how that makes scenarios like this one of people seeing a work of art by a artist from their country is unfortunately like a can be an unusual or uncommon experience. I loved it, and it's like 5 minutes long, but there's so much packed into that 5 minutes.
What are some of the other films that you saw?
That film was in this program that really surprised me. I mean, for a documentary film festival, it was an extremely experimental program, quite challenging at times. But I think, again, like, the fact that they didn't give you too much of it made it quite, it felt very kind of provocative, but in a pleasing way. I loved another film in that program called Walled Unwalled, which is by the visual artist and installation artist Lawrence Abu Hamdan. And he does work a lot of work with sound. So he's sort of, some of his work is just sound art, and some of his visual work is very much about sound and the way that sound works. And so this film, likewise, takes a number of stories that are quite familiar from the news, most notably Oscar Pistorius's murder trial, and looks at the changing role of kind of government's ability to perceive through walls, is my slightly clunky way of putting it. But he talks about how, for instance, in the Oscar Pistorius trial, it was explored how much neighbors of Oscar Pistorius could have possibly heard the things they claimed to hear, so whether that's a scream or a gunshot, and looking at the permeability of walls and how they impact that. He tells another story about a teenager, I think in the US somewhere, who was arrested on a drugs charge because the police had used a heat sensor to see the heat that was emanating through one of his house's walls, because of the heat lamps that he was using to grow marijuana, and how this was tested in court as to whether that is, you know, an acceptable use of police technology, mm-hmm. and whether, you know, your walls are considered private property or the heat that emanates through them is private or public. And so the film just explores, you know, these cases in a really kind of unusual visual manner. It's all set in this recording studio in Berlin. And you see, it almost functions like a kind of radio play. You know, the artist himself appears on screen throughout, and he's reading these stories while various other kind of elements are entering into the equation in the studio. There's a drummer. There's various people kind of moving things around. I loved how kind of visually and structurally ambitious it was, but also how direct it was in the themes and subjects it was exploring.
Do you think that there is more opportunity, or it's a little easier to be a little more experimental in terms of how you tell a story in a short versus in like a feature-length documentary?
Yeah, I think definitely. I mean, there obviously, when you're working with a smaller budget, as you almost always are with a short film, there are less kind of stakeholders in the sense of, you know, people worried about getting their money back or worried about how accessible the film may be or whatever else. And so I think you do have a little bit more leeway to experiment, which isn't to say that people don't get trapped in, you know, certain ways of thinking, and that certain commissioners or platforms don't want you to be working in kind of one mode. So I think I certainly relish the boundaries you can push in a short, because, you know, there's less kind of justification for people saying like, oh, I don't think an audience will follow you if you do that. And you're like, well, you know, they only have to follow for 14 minutes. Like, how bad can it be? So I think you do get a bit of a leeway in that way. But I'd like to say it's simpler, but I feel like my experiences have shown me the opposite. I'm quite looking forward to making another feature just because I feel like it will take the same amount of time and there's a lot more reward.
Is there any sort of moment in terms of even attention spans for documentary shorts right now, like in particular, that like you think suits them or their proliferation?
Yeah, I mean, it's like, I always find these things so funny because, you know, ever since the kind of major online platforms for short documentary have been around, which is what, like 5-10 years now, I feel like at any given moment, they all claim to know exactly what works and exactly what doesn't, but they change that from year to year. So like there was a moment where all films had to be 10 minutes and anything longer than 10 minutes, no one would ever watch. And then like literally 18 months later, the new thing was, oh no, people are watching them on their lunch break. They all need to be half an hour. And you're like, wow, that's like a big difference in what you've decided that people will exclusively watch. Viewers are a lot more willing to try something than they're often given credit for. It feels like the constraints are fully coming from the, you know, supply side. And actually, I think audiences are really open to a variety of material on the other end. And I think platforms are coming to recognize that. You know, you increasingly, whether it's New York Times or The Guardian or any of these things, you are increasingly seeing a real variation of runtime and styles and so on, and like, yeah, less of a house style, which I think can only be a good thing.
Charlie Lane, thank you so much for joining me. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you.
Charlie Lane's short, Lasting Marks, screened at this year's festival. His previous films, Personal Truth, Copycat, and Fish Story, have also shown at past Truth Falls festivals. He spoke with KBIA's Sebastian Martinez-Valdivi. Thanks for listening to this episode of Intersection. This True False Hangover episode was produced by Betsy Smith and me, with Molly Dove, Emily Aiken, Sam Mosier, and Sebastian Martinez-Valdivia. You can see more and other True False conversations at kbia.org. I'm Janet Saidi. Thanks for listening.